Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books in Israel Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Akin Ajayi, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Professor Moshe Shoked, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at Tel Aviv University, about his new book, Can Academics Change the World? An Israeli Anthropologist's Testimony on the Rise and Fall of a Protest Movement on Campus. Professor Shoked is a distinguished academic and researcher. He's written a number of books, including books on the gay community in New York and on Israeli expats to the United States. This new book, however, is a bit of a departure, and I think it's fair to say is a much more personal account of his journey as a member of ADCAN, a protest movement of Israeli academics at Tel Aviv University, fighting against the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories. It was founded during the first Palestinian Intifada of 1987 to 1993. Reading from the blurb of the book, it says that, however, since the assassination of Prime Minister Rabin and the subsequent obliteration of the Oslo Accords, public manifestations of dissent on Israeli campuses have been remarkably mute. This chronicle of ADCAN is explored in view of the ongoing theoretical discourse on the role of the intellectual in society and is compared with other accounts of academics' involvement in different countries during periods of acute political conflict. Professor Shoked, thank you very much for joining us. I'd like to start by asking if you could perhaps say a little bit about what prompted you to write this book.
A few years ago, just as I finished my last fieldwork project in New York, and looking back at my Israeli society, I was reminded of the one unusual period in my life, a moment that suddenly I wasn't the regular anthropologist studying other people, but participated in some most not exciting, but partly tragic situation in my society. It was the time of the first Palestinian Intifada. And somehow I had a feeling I have to write about it. It is an era and a situation that is not less interesting and important than my regular anthropological ethnographic project, telling the world or my colleagues about various fields of other people behavior. Then I wrote an article in Hebrew about the story of that time. And to my surprise, I couldn't publish it. Probably it was unpleasant to the editors that assume that I am I'm judging Israeli academics. And then I thought, okay, I write a book, and this is what I did. And this is what we are going to talk about that era as a member of a group of colleagues on campus, that we had no special relationships until then, and we were all active in our professions. Suddenly, we recruited ourselves to talk to Israeli society, and in a way, to the Palestinians as well, after 20 years of occupation. So, am I going to tell you now the story? To go.
Thank you very much. Yes, please. If you could tell us a little bit about how exactly Adkan came about in 1987.
I'm amazed to tell that it started with a short letter that a few days after the start of the first Intifada, the Palestinians uprising, I don't know why, I wrote a short letter to the Israeli liberal newspaper Haaretz. And the title was, "The Time is Ripe for Social Disobedience in Zion." And that short letter, actually, I expressed my feelings of horror that probably we are not so dissimilar at this minute from academics in some societies that we don't mention their names. And I always in on mind the, and I can say it clearly, and I said it, the German situation when it's a German academia didn't care about what is going on. And I thought, I'm not part of it. And to my amazement, many colleagues called me immediately. And I realized I can't go back home and forget it, just having expressed my nightmares. And so it started that we, together with a very close colleague, that he himself came from South Africa, and he outlived the story of the apartheid in South Africa, and we decided to invite interesting colleagues to come and discuss the situation. So we advertised in handwritten notes in a few faculties, calling for a meeting at the Faculty of Social Sciences. And no surprise, about 30 people came along. And then we realized we are going to do something about it. And that core group organized the first public conference on campus. And again, about 250 people arrived, lecturers and students. So this was the opening. And this was the first meeting in which colleagues from various professions, including two Arab colleagues from other universities, came, and people seemed to be interested and wishing to go on with these activities. The second conference, which was about 1 month later, this became actually the Rite de Passage, in which we invited Palestinians from the occupied territories such as a lawyer, a physician, an author, etc., to come and tell us about the situation in their communities. A few hours later, we were informed, it was also almost midnight, that the lawyer who came from Gaza was not arrested, but was taken for questioning and staying on. We decided we must do something about it. So the next day, we were ready with posters at the front of the home of the Mr. Rabin, who was at the time the Minister of Defense, and we protested, and also a journalist arrived. And when a short time later, the lawyer, Mr. Abu Shaban, was released, we felt we have done something, proved that we are not going to shut down. And I call it the Rite Passage, because this was the moment in which Atkan became an organization that was going to act for a few years until the Oslo Oslo agreement.
That's really interesting. The colleague you mentioned who joined you in setting up Atkan was Leon Sheleff, who himself was a distinguished sociologist before his untimely passing. I wanted to ask, did you have in mind any explicit objectives at this point in time, what you hoped as a collective of academics you could bring to a table and contribute to the conversation about Israel's occupation of the territories?
Our major intention and wish is to legitimize the PLO as partners to peace agreement. It was not allowed at the time to speak for the PLO, to meet with PLO even outside the country. For example, A.B. Nathan, a well-known personality, was taken to prison because he met with Mr. Arafat, and we wanted to legitimize Mr. Arafat. So, and this was in a way a new call in the country, that coming from this, many of our friends, colleagues were quite distinguished academics, and they were calling it in full volume, in demonstrations, in letters, in signing letters, in approaching also politicians. So in a way, this was our major ambition, to let Arafat be our partner and not be shameful or scared of calling his name and meeting with him and his colleagues.
I think it's fair to say that academics inhabit an important place in society because they have the time and they have expertise to actually explore the underpinnings of society, why we do what we do. And it strikes me that at this point in time that you're speaking of, outside academia, there may have been much less awareness or much less knowledge of the extent and the impact of the occupation. I wonder if you could paint a general picture of what general life outside academia in the country was in circa 1987, and how Atkan might have been in a position to actually educate or inform the population about the social political context of the moment.
We have to realize that during the 20 years of occupation, the feeling was among many people that the Palestinians didn't suffer. Actually, the economic situation to an extent improved. I can tell you that even in my case, I remember we refurbished our home and a few the Israeli guy who organized that the job recruited Palestinians from Gaza. They came every morning. They stayed for the day. We had some conversations with them. And it seemed that they were not complaining about the general situation. So I think that there was a sort of an idea. This is a benign occupation. It's good for both sides. Palestinians have a lot of jobs and work in Israel. And we had very little idea what is going on. In a way, people visited the Palestinians cities. I myself, with the people that I studied earlier in a village in the Negev, in the south, we visited the market in Gaza with them. And so I think the ordinary guy in Israel had no idea what is the undercurrent of feelings. Once the economic situation apparently improved, then people look for other things to improve. And of course, actually Palestinians visiting Israel, they have seen the difference of lifestyle, political situation. So I think there was a sort of ignorance at the time. It wasn't that Israelis were bad. It was that the feeling was that there is no way to to change the situation. After all, who started the 1967 war? It wasn't Israel that started the war. So in a way, I think that the 1967 war was a tragedy. I wish it hadn't happened.
Could you tell me a little bit about the reception here on campus at Tel Aviv University to this initiative? I ask this question in the context of the supposition that there wasn't necessarily wholehearted or complete support of an initiative on campus to try to educate the broader population about the iniquities of the occupation.
There was no support, but we were tolerated. University leadership wasn't too happy about that type of development, because after all, Israeli universities are basically supported by the state. Tel Aviv University couldn't survive without the support. But they respected, luckily, our group was distinguished enough academically, so we were treated quietly. We were allowed to use campus halls for the conferences. We were allowed to have our demonstration at the main square on campus. But there was no open support. Actually, the majority of the faculty were not against, they were not supportive. And I have the story of the Senate meeting, the university Senate meeting, in which our members of the Senate have raised a request that the Senate and the university publish a call to the government to open the academics the academic colleges in the West Bank. But unfortunately, we tried twice, and we lost. And we lost because our colleagues didn't support us. At the first time, they refused to have the issue raised at the Senate meeting. And the next time, we lost. We got enough votes for raising the issue for discussion, but eventually we lost it. And this was very painful for us.
Of course, I think academic solidarity is a very important issue, particularly academic solidarity between Israeli academics and their colleagues and colleagues in the West Bank. And perhaps we'll touch on that later on. I'm very interested, though, in something more specific and local at this point in time, which you talk about in the book, which is the greater participation from certain parts of the academic community here and less from others. So I think we talk about greater involvement by academics in the humanities and the social sciences, and perhaps less from the exact sciences. I wondered if you had any particular insights into why this might have been the case.
This was really amazing because the majority came from the social supporters, from the social sciences, from the humanities, so the law school, business administration, and education, and mathematics. They were an important part of the our organization, but from the biological, natural, physical part of campus, we had only one important active member, which was really, in a way, so clear. I used to call it that our members come from the West Bank of campus and not from the eastern part of campus. Now, usually also, it is not something unusual according to the literature, because also those who wrote about the academics and intellectuals in the social sciences and other sciences, like known people like I wouldn't name them now, they claim that probably the difference is that those who come from the human subjects are more related to social issues, to human relationships, while those who come from the other side, they are less involved in the human side of feelings, relationships, etc. And from that point of view, the Israeli case of Atkan is a very clear example of those writings about the academics' role in society. We shouldn't forget there were, of course, Tel Aviv University, Atkan, was unique in the Israeli environment. We had also some members who came from the Open University who joined us at the time, supporters openly. But this was, in a way, unusual, because there were individuals, intellectuals and academics, have an important role in society. We all know, I shouldn't name them, but they were not part of a group of a collective. We had some, even in Israel, some very well-known people, enough to mention the philosopher and biologist, Professor Yeshayahu Leibovitch, who was almost a prophet to this day. And we also invited him to our conferences. And he was a very powerful academic, not so much as an academic, as more as a philosopher, as a political prophet.
Indeed. Professor Leibovitz in particular is renowned as, I think, what we could describe as a moral philosopher, and certainly had a very, very powerful voice in the public sphere. Which brings me to a question that may not necessarily seem obvious to people out of academia, but it's nevertheless as important, which is to say, what risk was entailed by entering, putting your voice in the public sphere in what was a contentious issue? Were there any fears at the time that speaking out against the occupation might harm your professional career?
I think we were not scared. We were so, I'm in a way, I'm amazed. Probably this was also better times. I don't know what would have happened today. These are different days. But somehow, we enjoyed a sort of general respect, and we were not, personally, I never thought that something might happened to me. There were, of course, groups who came and protested against us. They called us Arafat guys. But we didn't consider them as a personal risk. Also on campus, people who didn't support us, but they didn't a fight against us. There was only, although there were some powerful men, the guy who used to be a university rector, and then Yuval Ne'eman, suddenly I lost his name. Yuval Ne'eman was a Knesset member. He was a party leader of the Tria, and he was the right of the right of the right, but he didn't touch, we were not affected by him, and we didn't care. We even, once he behaved unbelievably when the Israel Prize was given to the Arab author, his name suddenly Habibi. I'm not repeating the way that he behaved during the ceremony, but we decided to have a conference for Habibi. To respect him on campus. So at that time, I don't know what would have happened today when right wingers are far more dangerous in my eyes. And it's enough to see what is happening at the West Bank and to think what might have happened today. What might have, at that time, at least I can tell the story of the during the meeting, the Senate meeting, a very well-known law professor, he told the audience, look, if you interfere in political issues, then the government might take part and against us on academic issues. And this, at that time, people took it seriously. And probably he was right.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Thank you very much. Just a reminder that we're talking today about the book, Can Academics Change the World? An Israeli anthropologist's testimony on the rise and fall of a protest movement on campus by Professor Moshe Shoked, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology, at Tel Aviv University. I want us to take a slightly broader look at the role of academics and academia in contributing to general society, and specifically the Israeli case. There isn't, I think it's fair to say, at least at this point in time we're talking about the late 1980s, a concerted role for academics in political discourse. A decade earlier, there had been a political party, Dash, who you talk about in your book, that was a collection of intellectual elites and academics. But broadly speaking, could you give us a bit of a sense about how involved the Israeli academic was in the political scene in Israel in the late 1980s, at the time when Adkan started?
I think the history of the academics in Israel is quite good, in, as one can say. We shouldn't forget that Ben-Gurion had his, some of his close friends, or we believe that they are close friends, were well-known academics. And there is the history of Jewish life, Jewish history, that the literati are important. They have, but they were considered, they had an important part in during life, society, Israeli society, but they were not often politically engaged. So from that point of view, I don't think that something had radically changed. The only thing is that if I try to think what happened since then, And I think that some things have happened, although the general university and colleges environment expanded tremendously, yet it was modeled to the professional life. You have to be good at your task. Israeli academics apparently are situated far away from the centers of science, yet they have to prove themselves. From that point of view, I think that Israeli academics should be acknowledged for their for the unusual contribution and position in world science. As we usually see it now, when it comes to the high-tech businesses, but we are unaware about their contribution in different subjects of science, which they do, or at least they used to do extremely well. It's enough to see how many Israeli students have jobs in American and European universities. Whenever you see them, even on television, that they are being interviewed from various universities and from some good universities. I remember a colleague from the Department of the Economics here told me that the Department of Economics and Business in Northwestern, people in the corridors, they speak Hebrew. How did they come to that? They were educated in Israel, which means that we at least we used to have some good universities. On the others, yet I am a bit worried that some of our best students disappear, and we offer to the world a free tax some many good people.
Thank you very much. Something that, reading the book, I enjoyed the book very much because it wasn't just simply a narrative of an event, so a particular point in time, but it was also a very, very nuanced and very, very personal account of your involvement in what was a grassroots movement that over time developed into having, I think it's fair to say, a significant voice for a while in political discourse in Israel. And I'm particularly interested in your approach, both as a member of ATCAN and in detailing its history now as an anthropologist. I wondered if you could say something about what the anthropologist's eye can bring to understanding society, specifically Israeli society.
As I think I mentioned earlier, this was the first time that I took a major part in the ethnography. So usually when we talk about ethnography, we talk about telling about other people that we have observed them. In this case, I moved out of the anthropologist role by being my own major informant. True, I relied very much on my on the records that I have in my office of all the posters and all the other documents, and I interviewed preparing the book a good number of ATCAN colleagues, but no doubt I am, for better or worse, I am the major informant. And probably when I started my career, it would have been bizarre to write a book in which you are a major, I wouldn't call it the hero, but the major informant and recorder. But I think that These days, anthropology has changed, and we call it the era of reflexivity, in which anthropologists are being allowed, and not more allowed, but even expected, to document and to show their own feelings and part in the research. So people can also find out and judge, is it a good job? Or probably we can claim something against it. But I took the liberty, and I thought at that stage of life, I can afford it. People would take it or not, but I had my say.
Thank you very much. In terms of the immediate objectives of ADCAN, you were looking at introducing the Palestinian voice into a broader discourse about what happens to Palestinian citizens and the occupied territories. Taking that into account, do you feel that you, as an organization, succeeded in these objectives? And at what point did you feel that it was time to call a halt on your activities as a pressure group?
I think that actually we didn't foresee what is going to happen. We believed at the time that we were absolutely successful. It was wonderful. I remember attending the event when Mr. Rabin was assassinated. It was a wonderful evening at what is called now Rabin Square. The Oslo agreements actually realized our dreams and our whatever we have done. And when we decided to shut the business, we thought there is no need. We have done our job. And now we go back to our regular occupation. So it took quite a number of years to realize that it doesn't work. And at that time, we were not very young at the time. We were not very young anymore. And we didn't come back to reorganize. Is including, for example, my close colleague Leon Shalev passed away early. So personally, I lost my major partner, and I was going to retire soon. So there wasn't some, and all the atmosphere has changed. This was, we can sit and analyze the changes they've taken within 20 years. Actually, what is that? Israel is an amazing society in which things are changing so quickly. Since then, for example, imagine the immigration from the Soviet Union, which made a great change in Israeli society, for example, and other developments that happened so quickly. Imagine what happened to the kibbutz, that suddenly its role in society disappeared completely. So things have changed so quickly that it would have been a completely different situation to start and look at what is happening. Only things at the settlements. During the ADCAN era, there were how many settlers? I suppose no more than 50,000 or something like that. And imagine today, it's 500,000. So the land has changed. And look what happened with the Palestinians. We talk all the time only about the Israelis, but we shouldn't forget what has happened among the Palestinians. The rise of Hamas, for example. Only that. Imagine what happened in Gaza. So we have also partners to the game, and things have changed immensely also among the Palestinians. So these are not the day of Arafat. These are completely different days, and we can't look at that situation only from the Israeli side.
Of course, the context that we're thinking about here is, first of all, mutual recognition of the Palestinian Liberation Organization and of the State of Israel, the famous handshake of the White House lawn, the Oslo Accords, which granted the Palestinian Authority limited and contingent autonomy over parts of Palestine, as part of what at the time was hoped would be some sort of final two-state settlement agreement. But we're here in 2022, and we seem a lot further away from that than where we've been in the mid-90s, at the time that ADCAN came to its natural end. I suppose I'm interested in thinking about, and it's something that's touched upon in detail, not just in the title of the book, but in the text as well, which is the continuing role of academics in introducing a diversity of voices, a diversity of opinions, and broadening our knowledge about matters that impact upon all of us. What are your thoughts about the role of a place, of the activity of academics in political discourse in Israel today?
I must confess that I am not sure about. I am now in a different stage of life. Still, I believe that had I been young, I would have started ADCAN again. Because I think that we don't realize the extent of academics' impact on society. Probably I am a dreamer, but I think that academics could be a stronger part in the ongoing political life. At least we could see the fight, if there is a fight. Academics are not leftist by ideology, as if by religion. Academics they know the facts. They could talk to power, not about feelings necessarily, not about ideology, but about the real situation on the ground. Where is it going to lead us, these developments? Because it's not enough to build settlements. You have to think about what is going to be the other things around them. What is going to happen with the Palestinians around them? Of course, everybody knows it's political, but it's not only political. It's also about the real life situation of Israelis within the old borders and outside the old borders. And I think that academics, as a group of organized groups, talking truth to power, they could have a much more important role than today, that they are hardly known around. They are professors, okay. They are good. They are good scientists. They are good writers. They invent. Only recently, we are being told about a wonderful invention at Tel Aviv University in the health situation. But as much as they are going to affect real life, they are not going to affect political life.
I am conscious of the fact that academics operate in a world of nuance and of subtlety. And the world we live in today is increasingly polarized. And I'm also aware of the fact that academics may face pressures, professional pressures, that perhaps were not the case 30 years ago. I wonder if you had any thoughts about the overarching objectives and the operation of the Boycott, Diversify and Sanctions campaign as it applies to Israeli academia, and whether this, on the one hand, pushes academics, Israeli academics, into a position where they may be afraid of compromising their own positions, or conversely, whether it could be broadened to create a space where academics, broadly speaking, can express solidarity for one another in working together towards a collective goal, which...
The BDS is problematic, and because there is a lot of bluff about it, not because the Israelis are good, but because the BDS is targeting Israel, while at the same time they don't target Chinese academia, they don't target American academia. But don't forget the little role, if at all, they had at the academics at the Iraqi invasion, or what is happening in China, some unbelievable events, including whatever. I don't have to tell the stories. So the BDS, from that point of view, is ineffective because it is not presented itself and is not seen as being neutral, which of course we all talk about neutrality, being objective, but how can you attack the Israeli-Palestinian situation and forget what is happening, for example, in China, which is we all know the country. Anyhow, I lost the name. Anyhow, so this is why eventually the BDS is not going to be effective, as it happened in South Africa at the time. And eventually, because universities are not that important as we see it in real time. So academics, Israeli academics, they are not terribly affected. I was accused a few times as a person, although apparently BDS is attacking universities, organizations, not individuals. But, you know, I survived. And for the time being, I think that we are in a good company of bad countries, but that still it doesn't mean that I accept the Israeli situation as it is. I'm absolutely I'm horrified about this intractable conflict. It must come to an end, or God knows how it will end one day. But I will not see it.
I think one thing is clear is that however it does end, it must come about with the contribution of people who are well placed to give us a clearer and more textured understanding of the facts of the matter. And in that context, I think that your book provides rather privileged and rather fascinating snapshots of an opportunity that academics in Israel did take to try to effect a difference to a matter that is of concern to everyone in the country. Professor Shoked, you've been very, very generous with your time. I'd like to thank you for talking with us. Before we round up, I'd just like to ask if you could say anything about anything that you're working on, anything of interest that you might want to share with us about your work at the moment.
Writing is my major ability. And as I say, I can't open the day without having something to write about. So actually, I am finishing now, and it's being already edited, a book about my ethnographic experiences in various fields, in working in Israel and the United States, as a sort of showing pictures, not in the real sense, of chapters about different sites and societies and organizations I studied. And again, from that point of view, more in a more reflexive manner, which I believe is going to be more readable. And I closed that book with the chapters about the people who have influenced my career as teachers, colleagues, informants, and friends. So in a way, I feel probably it may be the last book, but as I say, I can't start another day without having to write something about or complain or write a letter to the newspaper. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Professor Shokade. So we've been talking today about can academics change the world? An Israeli anthropologist's testimony on the rise and fall of the protest movement on campus by Professor Moshe Shokade, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at Tel Aviv University. The book is published by Berghahn in collaboration with the European Association of Social Anthropologists, and I do recommend it. It's a fascinating and interesting read with a particular resonance for the conversation about the involvement of academics in wider discourse in the present time. Professor Shokade, thank you very much.